intelligence, more often winning than losing. And every year things got better. Progress was never fast enough, but it was real and could be measured. And perhaps she'd live long enough to see the last dragon on her unit die once and for all. But there was more than one kind of dragon, wasn't there? Some couldn't be killed with kindness and medications and skilled nursing care. She'd defeated one, but another had killed Doris anyway. That dragon needed the sword, in the hands of a warrior. The sword was a tool, wasn't it? A necessary tool if you wanted to slay that particular dragon. Perhaps it was one she could never use herself, but necessary nonetheless. Someone had to hold that sword. John wasn't a bad man at all, just realistic. She fought her dragons, he fought his. It was the same fight. She'd been wrong to judge him. Now she understood, seeing in her eyes the same emotion that she'd beheld months earlier in his, as her rage passed, but not very far, and the determination set in.
"Well, everybody lucked out," Hicks said, handing over a beer.
"How so, Wally?" Peter Henderson asked.
"The mission was a washout. It aborted just in time. Didn't even get anyone hurt in the process, thank God. Everyone's flying home right now."
"Good news, Wally," Henderson said, meaning it. He didn't want to kill anybody either. He just wanted the damned war to end, the same as Wally did. It was a shame about the men in that camp, but some things couldn't be helped.
"What happened exactly?"
"Nobody knows yet. You want me to find out?"
Peter nodded.
"Carefully. It's something the Intelligence Committee ought to know about when the agency fucks up like that. I can get the information to them, but you have to be careful."
"No problem. I'm learning how to stroke Roger."
Hicks lit up his first joint of the evening, annoying his guest.
"You could lose your clearance that way, you know."
"Well, gee, then I'll have to join Dad and make a few mil on the street, eh?"
"Wally, do you want to change the system, or do you want to let other people keep it the same?"
Hicks nodded.
"Yeah, I suppose."
The following winds had allowed the KC-135 to make the hop in from Hawaii without a refueling stop, and the landing was a gentle one. Remarkably, Kelly's sleep cycle was about right now. It was 5 in the afternoon, and in another 6 or 7 hours he'd be ready for more sleep.
"Can I get a day or two off?"
"We'll want you back to Quantico for an extended debrief," Ritter told him, stiff and sore from the extended flight.
"Fine, just so I'm not in custody or anything. I could use a lift up to Baltimore."
"I'll see what I can do," Greer said as the plane came to a halt.
Two security officers from the agency were the first up the mobile stairs, even before the oversized cargo hatch swung up. Ritter woke the Russian up.
"Welcome to Washington."
"Take me to my embassy?" he asked, hopefully. Ritter almost laughed.
"Not quite yet. We'll find you a nice, comfortable place, though."
Grishinov was too groggy to object, rubbing his head and needing something for the pain. He went with the security officers down the steps to their waiting car. It left at once for a safe house near Winchester, Virginia.
"Thanks for the try, John," Admiral Maxwell said, taking the younger man's hand.
"I'm sorry for what I said before," Kaz said, doing the same.
"You were right."
They, too, had a car waiting. Kelly watched them enter it from the hatch.
"So what happens to them?" he asked Greer.
James shrugged, leading Kelly out and down the stairs. Noise from other aircraft made his voice hard to hear.
"Dutch was in line for a fleet and maybe the CNO's job. I don't suppose that'll happen now. The operation, well, it was his baby and it didn't get born. That'll finish him."
"That's not fair," Kelly said loudly. Greer turned.
"No, it isn't, but that's the way things are."
Greer, too, had a ride waiting. He directed his driver to head to the wing headquarters building, where he arranged a car to take Kelly to Baltimore.
"Get some rest and call me when you're ready. Bob was serious about what he said. Think it over."
"Yes, sir," Kelly replied, heading to the blue Air Force sedan. It was amazing, Kelly thought, the way life was. Within 5 minutes, the sergeant drove onto an interstate highway. Scarcely 24 hours earlier, he'd been on a ship approaching Subic Bay. 36 hours prior to that, he'd been on the soil of an enemy country. And now here he was in the back seat of a government Chevy, and the only dangers to which he was exposed came from other drivers, at least for a little while. All the familiar things, the highway exit signs painted that pleasant shade of green, traveling in the last half of the local rush hour. Everything about him proclaimed the normality of life, when 3 days earlier everything had been alien and hostile. Most amazing of all, he'd adjusted to it. The driver didn't speak a word except to inquire about directions, though he must have wondered who the man was that had arrived on a special flight. Perhaps he had many such jobs, Kelly mused, as the car pulled off Lochraven Boulevard. Enough that he'd stopped wondering about things he'd never be told. Thanks for the lift, Kelly told him. Yes, sir, you're welcome. The car pulled away and Kelly walked to his apartment, amused that he'd taken his keys all the way to Vietnam and back. Did the keys know how far they had come? 5 minutes later he was in the shower, the quintessentially American experience, changing from one reality into another. Another 5 and he was dressed in slacks and a short-sleeved shirt, and headed out the door to his scout, parked a block away. Another 10 and he'd parked the car within sight of Sandy's bungalow. The walk from his scout to her door was yet another transition. He'd come home to something, Kelly told himself, for the first time.
John!
He hadn't expected the hug, even less so the tears in her eyes. It's okay, Sandy. I'm fine. No holes or scratches or anything. He was slow to grasp the desperation of her hold on him, pleasant as it was. But then the face against his chest started sobbing, and he knew that this event was not for him at all. What's wrong?
They killed Doris.
Time stopped again. It seemed to split into many pieces. Kelly closed his eyes, in pain at first. And in that instant he was back on his hilltop overlooking Cinder Green, watching the NVA troops arrive. He was in his hospital bed looking at a photograph. He was outside some nameless village listening to the screams of children. He'd come home all right, but to the same thing he'd left. No, he realized, to the thing that he had never left, which followed him everywhere he went. He'd never get away from it because he'd never really finished it, not even once. Not even once. And yet there was a new element as well, this woman holding him and feeling the same blazing pain that sliced through his chest. What happened, Sandy?
We got her well, John. We took her home, and then I called today like you told me to. And a policeman answered. Doris and her father, too, both murdered.
Okay. He moved her to the sofa. He wanted at first to let her calm down, not to hold her too close, but that didn't work. She clung to him, letting out the feelings that she'd closeted off along with worry for his safety, and he held Sandy's head to his shoulder for several minutes. Sam and Sarah?
I haven't told them yet.
Her face came up, and she looked across the room, her gaze unfocused. Then the nurse in her came out, as it had to.
How are you?
A little frazzled from all the traveling, he said, just to put words after her question. Then he had to tell the truth. It was a washout. The mission didn't work. They're still there.
I don't understand.
We were trying to get some people out of North Vietnam, prisoners, but something went wrong. Failed again, he added quietly.
Was it dangerous?
Kelly managed a grunt. Yes, Sandy, you might say that, but I came out okay. Sandy set that one aside.
Doris said there were others. Other girls, they still have 'em.
Yeah, Billy said the same thing. I'm going to try and get them out. Kelly noticed she didn't react to his mention of Billy's name.
It won't matter, getting them out, unless...
I know. The thing that kept following him around, Kelly thought. There was only one way to make it stop. Running couldn't distance him from it. He had to turn and face it.
Well, Henry, that little job was taken care of this morning, Piaggi told him. Nice and clean.
They didn't leave.
Henry, they were two pros, okay?
They did the job, and now they're back home, a couple hundred miles away. They didn't leave anything behind except for the two bodies. The phone report had been very clear on that. It had been an easy job, since neither target had expected anything.
"Then that's that," Tucker observed with satisfaction.
He reached into his pocket and pulled out a fat envelope. He handed it to Piaggi, who had fronted the money himself, good partner that he was.
"With Eddie out of the way, and with that leak plugged, things ought to go back to normal."
"Best $20,000 I ever spent," Henry thought. "Henry, the other girls," Piaggi pointed out. "You've got a real business now. People inside like them are dangerous. Take care of it, okay?" He pocketed the envelope and left the table.
22s, back of the head, both of them, the Pittsburgh detective reported over the phone. "We've dusted the whole house, nothing. The flower box, nothing. The truck, nothing. The truck was stolen sometime last night, this morning, whatever. The florist has 8 of them. Hell, we recovered it before the All Points was on the air. It was wise guys, had to be. Too smooth, too clean for local talent. No word on the street. They're probably out of town already. 2 people saw the truck. One woman saw 2 guys walking to the door. She figured it was a flower delivery, and besides, she was across the street half a block away. No description, nothing. She doesn't even remember what color they were." Ryan and Douglas were listening on the same line, and their eyes met every few seconds. They knew it all from the tone of the man's voice, the sort of case that policemen hate and fear. No immediately apparent motive, no witnesses, no usable evidence. Nowhere to start and nowhere to go. The routine was as predictable as it was futile. They'd pumped the neighbors for information, but it was a working-class neighborhood, and few had been at home at the time. People noticed mainly the unusual, and a flower truck wasn't unusual enough to attract the inquiring look that developed into a physical description. Committing the perfect murder wasn't really all that demanding. A secret known within the fraternity of detectives and belied by a whole body of literature that made them into superhuman beings they never claimed to be, even among themselves in a cop bar. Someday the case might be broken. One of the killers might be caught for something else and cop to this one in order to get a deal. Less likely someone would talk about it, bragging in front of an informant who'd pass it along to someone else. But in either case it would take time, and the trail, cold as it already was, would grow colder still. It was the most frustrating part of the business of police work. Truly innocent people had died, and there was no one to speak for them, to avenge their deaths. And other cases would come up, and the cops would set this one aside for something fresher. And from time to time someone would reopen the file and look things over, then put it back in the unsolved drawer, where it would grow thicker only because of the forms that announced that there was still nothing new on the case. It was even worse for Ryan and Douglas. Yet again there had been a possible link that might open up 2 of their unsolved files. Everyone would care about Raymond and Doris Brown. They'd had friends and neighbors, evidently a good minister. They'd be missed, and people would think what a shame it was. But the files on Ryan's desk were for people about whom no one but police officers cared. And somehow that only made it worse, because someone should mourn for the dead, not just cops who were paid to do so. Worse still, it was yet another M.O. in a string of homicides that were somehow linked, but not in a way that made any sense. This was not their invisible man. Yes, the weapon had been a .22, but he'd had a chance to kill the innocent twice. He'd spared Virginia Charles, and he had somehow gone dangerously far out of his way to spare Doris Brown. He had saved her from Farmer and Grayson, probably, and someone else. "Detective," Ryan asked, "what was the condition of Doris's body?" "What do you mean?"
It seemed an absurd question, even as his mind formed it, but the man on the other end of the line would understand. "What was her physical condition?"
"The autopsy is tomorrow, Lieutenant. She was neatly dressed, all cleaned up. Hair was nice. She looked pretty decent."
"Except for the 2 holes in the back of her head," the man didn't have to add. Douglas read his lieutenant's mind and nodded. Somebody took the time to get her well. That was a starting place. I'd appreciate it if you could send me anything that might be useful. It'll work both ways, Ryan assured him. Some guy went way out of his way to murder them. We don't see many like this. I don't like it very much, the detective added. It was a puerile conclusion, but Ryan fully understood. How else did you say it, after all? It was called a safe house, and it was indeed safe. Located on 100 rolling acres in the Virginia hills, there was on the estate a stately house and a 12-stall stable half-occupied with hunter jumpers. The title for the house showed a name, but that person owned another place nearby and leased this one to the Central Intelligence Agency, actually to a shadow corporation that existed only as a piece of paper and a post office box, because he'd served his time in OSS. And besides, the money was right. Nothing unusual from the outside, but a more careful inspection might show that the doors and door frames were steel, the windows unusually thick and strong and sealed. It was as secure from outside assault and from an internal attempt at escape as a maximum security prison, just a lot more pleasant to behold. Grishinov found clothing to wear and shaving things that worked but with which he couldn't harm himself. The bathroom mirror was steel, and the cup in the holder was paper. The couple that managed the house spoke passable Russian and were just as pleasant as they could be, already briefed on the nature of their new guest. They were more accustomed to defectors, though all their visitors were protected by a team of 4 security guards inside who came when they had company, and 2 more who lived full-time in the caretaker's house close to the stables. Not unusually, their guest was out of sync with local time, and his disorientation and unease made him talkative. They were surprised that their orders were to limit their conversations to the mundane. The lady of the house fixed breakfast, always the best meal for the jet-lagged, while her husband launched a discussion of Pushkin, delighted to find that, like many Russians, Grishinov was a serious devotee of poetry. The security guard leaned against the doorframe, just to keep an eye on things. "The things I have to do, Sandy." "John, I understand," she told him quietly. Both were surprised at how strong her voice was, how determined. "I didn't before, but I do now. When I was over there, was it only 3 days before? I thought about you. I need to thank you," he told her.
"What for?"
Kelly looked down at the kitchen table. "Hard to explain. It's scary, the things I do. It helps when you have somebody to think about." "Excuse me, I don't mean..." Kelly stopped. He did actually mean that. The mind wanders when alone, and his had wandered. Sandy took his hand and smiled in a gentle way. "I used to be afraid of you."
"Why?"
he asked with considerable surprise.
"Because of the things you do."
"I'd never hurt you," he said without looking up, yet more miserable now that she had felt the need to fear him.
"I know that now."
Despite her words, Kelly felt a need to explain himself. He wanted her to understand, not realizing that she already did. How to do it? Yes, he killed people, but only for a reason. How had he come to be what he was? Training was part of it, the rigorous months spent at Coronado, the time and effort spent to inculcate automatic responses, more deadly still, to learn patience. Along with that had somehow come a new way of seeing things, and then actually seeing them and seeing the reasons why killing sometimes had to be. Along with the reasons had come a code, a modification, really, of what he'd learned from his father. His actions had to have a purpose, usually assigned by others, but his mind was agile enough to make its own decisions, to fit his code into a different context, to apply it with care, but to apply it. A product of many things, he sometimes surprised himself with what he was. Someone had to try, and he most often was best suited to...
"You love too much, John," she said. "You're like me."
Those words brought his head up.
"We lose patience on my floor. We lose them all the time. And I hate it. I hate being there when life goes away. I hate watching the family cry and knowing that we couldn't stop it from happening. We all do our best. Professor Rosen is a wonderful surgeon, but we don't always win, and I hate it when we lose. And with Doris, we won that one, John, and somebody took her away anyway. And that wasn't disease or some damned auto accident. Somebody meant to do it. She was one of mine, and somebody killed her and her father. So I do understand, okay? I really do.
Jesus, she really does. Better than me. Everybody connected with Pam and Doris, you're all in danger now. Sandy nodded.
You're probably right. She told us things about Henry. I know what kind of person he is. I'll tell you everything she told us.
You do understand what I'm going to do with that information?
Yes, John, I do. Please be careful.
She paused and told him why he had to be.
I want you back.
Chapter 32. Home is the Prey. The one bit of usable information to come out of Pittsburgh was a name. Sandy. Sandy had driven Doris Brown back home to her father. Just one word, not even a proper name. But cases routinely broke on less than that. It was like pulling on a string. Sometimes all you got was a broken piece of thread. Sometimes you got something that just didn't stop until everything unraveled into a tangled mess in your hands. Somebody named Sandy. A female voice. Young. She'd hung up before saying anything, though it hardly seemed likely that she'd had anything at all to do with the murders. One might return to the scene of the crime. It really did happen, but not via telephone. How did it fit in? Ryan leaned back in his chair, staring at the ceiling while his trained mind examined everything he knew. The most likely supposition was that Doris Brown, deceased, had been directly connected with the same criminal enterprise that had killed Pamela Madden and Helen Waters, and that had also included as active members Richard Farmer and William Grayson. John Terence Kelly, former UDT sailor, and perhaps a former Navy SEAL, had somehow happened upon and rescued Pamela Madden. He'd called Frank Allen about it several weeks later, telling him not very much. Something had gone badly wrong. Short version, he'd been an ass. And Pamela Madden had died as a result. The photos of the body were something Ryan would never fully put from his mind. Kelly had been badly shot. A former commando whose girlfriend had been brutally murdered, Ryan reminded himself. Five pushers eliminated as though James Bond had appeared on the streets of Baltimore. One extraneous killing in which the murderer had intervened in a street robbery for reasons unknown. Richard Farmer, Rick, eliminated with a knife. The second possible show of rage, and the first one didn't count, Ryan reminded himself. William Grayson, probably kidnapped and killed. Doris Brown, probably rescued at the same time. Cleaned up over a period of weeks and returned to her home. That meant some sort of medical care, didn't it? Probably. Maybe, he corrected himself. The invisible man, could he have done that himself? Doris was the girl who'd brushed out Pamela Madden's hair. There was a connection. Back up. Kelly had rescued the Madden girl, but he'd had help getting her straightened out. Professor Sam Rosen and his wife, another physician. So, Kelly finds Doris Brown. Whom would he take her to? That was a starting place. Ryan lifted his phone.
Hello?
Doc, it's Lieutenant Ryan.
I didn't know I gave you my direct line, Farber said. What's up?
Do you know Sam Rosen?
Professor Rosen? Sure. He runs a department. Hell of a good cutter. World class.
I don't see him very often, but if you ever need a head worked on, he's the man. And his wife? Ryan could hear the man sucking on his pipe.
I know her quite well, Sarah. She's a pharmacologist, research fellow across the street, also works with our drug abuse unit. I help out with that group, too, and we...
Thank you, Ryan cut him off. One more name. Sandy.
Sandy who?
That's all I have, Lieutenant Ryan admitted.
He could imagine Farber now leaning away from his desk in the high-backed leather chair with his contemplative look.
Let me make sure I understand things, okay? Are you asking me to check up on two colleagues as part of a criminal investigation? Ryan weighed the merits of lying. This guy was a psychiatrist. His job was looking around in people's minds. He was good at it. Yes, doctor, I am, the detective admitted after a pause long enough for the psychiatrist to make an accurate guess as to its cause. You're going to have to explain yourself, Farber announced evenly. Sam and I aren't exactly close, but he is not a person who would ever hurt another human being. And Sarah is a damned angel with these messed up kids we see in here. She's setting aside some important research work to do that. Stuff she could make a big reputation with. Then Farber realized that she'd been away an awful lot in the past couple of weeks. Doctor, I'm just trying to develop some information, okay? I have no reason whatever to believe that either one of them is implicated in any illegal act. His words were too formal, and he knew it. Perhaps another tack. It was even honest, maybe. If my speculation is correct, there may be some danger to them that they don't know about. Give me a few minutes. Farber broke the connection. Not bad, Em, Douglas said. It was bottom fishing, Ryan thought, but hell, he'd tried just about everything else. It seemed an awfully long 5 minutes before the phone rang again. Ryan? Farber. No docs on Neuro by that name. One nurse, though, Sandra O'Toole. She's a team leader on the service. I don't know her myself. Sam thinks highly of her, or so I just found out from his secretary. She was working something special for him recently. He had to fiddle the pay records. Farber had already made his own connection. Sarah had been absent from her clinical work at the same time. He'd let the police develop that themselves. He'd gone far enough. Too far. These were colleagues, after all, and this wasn't a game. When was that? Ryan asked casually. 2 or 3 weeks ago, lasted 10 working days. Thank you, Doctor. I'll be back to you. Connection, Douglas observed after the circuit was broken. How much you want to bet that she knows Kelly, too? The question was more hopeful than substantive, of course. Sandra was a common enough name. Still, they'd been on this case, this endless series of deaths, for more than 6 months. And after all that time spent with no evidence and no connections at all, it looked like the morning star. The problem was that it was evening now, and time to go home for dinner with his wife and children. Jack would be returning to Boston College in another week or so, Ryan thought, and he missed time with his son. There was no easy way to get things organized. Sandy had to drive him to Quantico. It was her first time on a Marine base, but only briefly, as Kelly guided her to the marina. Already, he thought. You get home for once with your body in tune with the local day-night cycle, and already he had to break it. Sandy was not yet back on I-95 when he pulled away from the dock, heading out for the middle of the river, advancing his throttles to max cruise as soon as he could. The lady had brains to go with her guts, Kelly told himself, sipping his first beer in a very long time. He supposed it was normal that a clinical nurse would have a good memory. Henry, it seemed, had been a talker at certain moments, one of them being when he had a girl under his direct control. A boastful man, Kelly thought. The best sort. He still didn't have an address to go along with the phone number, but he had a new name. Tony P. something. PG, something like that. White, Italian, drove a blue Lincoln, along with a decent physical description. Mafia, probably. Either in it or a wannabe. Somebody else named Eddie. But Sandy had matched that with a guy who had been killed by a police officer. It had made the front page of the local paper. Kelly took it one step further. What if that cop was the man Henry had inside? It struck him as odd that a senior officer like a lieutenant would be involved in a shooting. Speculation, he told himself, but worth checking out. He wasn't sure yet exactly how. He had all night for it, and a smooth body of water to reflect his thoughts as it did the stars. Soon he passed the spot where he'd left Billy. At least someone had collected the body.
The ground was settling over the grave in a place that some still called Potter's Field, a tradition dating back to someone named Judas. The doctors at the community hospital that had treated the man were still going over the pathology report from the Medical College of Virginia. Barotrauma. There were fewer than 10 severe cases of this condition in the whole country in a year, and all of those in coastal regions. It was no disgrace that they hadn't made the diagnosis. And, the report went on, there was no difference it could have made. The precise cause of death had been a fragment of bone marrow that had somehow found its way into a cerebral artery, occluding it and causing a massive fatal stroke. Damage to other organs had been so extensive that it would only have been a matter of a few more weeks in any case. The bone marrow blockage was evidence of a very large pressurization imbalance, 3 bar, probably more. Even now, police were inquiring about divers in the Potomac, which could be very deep in some places. There was still hope that someone would eventually claim the body, whose location was recorded in the county administrator's office. But not much.
"What do you mean you don't know?" General Rokossovsky demanded. "He's my man. Did you misplace him?"
"Comrade General," Yap replied sharply, "I have told you everything I know."
"And you say an American did it?"
"You have seen the intelligence information as well as I have.
That man has information that the Soviet Union requires. I find it hard to believe that the Americans planned a raid whose only result was the abduction of the one Soviet officer in the area. I would suggest, Comrade General, that you make a more serious effort."
"We are at war."
"Yes, I am aware of that," Rokossovsky observed dryly. "Why do you think I am here?"
Gyap could have sworn at the taller man who stood before his desk. He was the commander of his country's armed forces, after all, and a general of no mean abilities himself. The Vietnamese general swallowed his pride with difficulty. He also needed the weapons that only the Russians could provide, and so he had to abase himself before him for the sake of his country. Of one thing he was certain. The camp wasn't worth the trouble it had caused him. The strange part was that the routine had become relatively benign. Kolya wasn't there. That was certain. Zacharias was sufficiently disoriented that he had difficulty determining the passage of days. But for 4 sleeps now, he hadn't heard the Russian's voice even outside the door. By the same token, no one had come in to abuse him. He'd eaten and sat and thought in solitude. To his surprise, it had made things better instead of worse. His time with Kolya had become an addiction more dangerous than his dalliance with alcohol, Robin saw now. It was loneliness that was his real enemy, not pain, not fear. From a family and a religious community that fostered fellowship, he'd entered a profession that lived on the same, and being denied it, his mind had fed on itself. Then add a little pain and fear, and what did you have? It was something far more easily seen from without than from within. Doubtless it had been apparent to Kolya. "Like you," he'd said so often. "Like you." So, Zacharias told himself, that's how he did his job. Cleverly, too, the colonel admitted to himself. Though not a man accustomed to failure and mistakes, he was not immune to them. He'd almost killed himself with a youthful error at Luke Air Force Base while learning to fly fighters. And 5 years later, the time he'd wondered what the inside of a thunderstorm was really like, and nearly ended up hitting the ground in the manner of a thunderbolt. And now he'd made another. Zacharias didn't know the reason for his respite from the interrogations. Perhaps Kolya was off reporting on what he'd learned. Whatever the reason, he had been granted the chance to reflect. "You've sinned," Robin told himself. "You've been very foolish. But you won't do that again." The determination was weak, and Zacharias knew he'd have to work to strengthen it. Fortunately, he now had the time for reflection. If it was not a real deliverance, it was something. Suddenly, he was shocked into full concentration, as if he were flying a combat mission. "My God," he thought, "that word. I was afraid to pray for deliverance, and yet..."
His guards would have been surprised to see the wistful smile on his face, especially had they known that he was starting to pray again. Prayer, they'd all been taught, was a farce. But that was their misfortune, Robin thought, and might yet be his salvation. He couldn't make the call from his office. It just wouldn't do. Nor did he wish to do so from his home. The call would cross a river and a state line, and he knew that for security reasons there were special provisions for telephone calls made in the D.C. area. They were all recorded on computer tape, the only place in America where that was true. Even so, there was a procedure for what he had to do. You were supposed to have official sanction for it. You had to discuss it with your section head, then with the chief of the directorate, and it could well go all the way to the front office on the 7th floor. Ritter didn't want to wait that long, not with lives at stake. He took the day off, not unreasonably claiming that he needed the time to recover from all the travel. So he decided to drive into town and picked the Smithsonian's Museum of Natural History. He walked past the elephant in the lobby and consulted the You Are Here plate on the wall to find the public telephones, into one of which he dropped a dime and called 347-1347. It was almost an institutional joke. That number connected him to a telephone that rang on the desk of the KGB resident, the chief of station for Washington, D.C. They knew, and knew that people interested knew they knew. The espionage business could be so baroque, Ritter told himself. Yes, a voice said. It was the first time Ritter had done this, a whole new collection of sensations. His own nervousness, the evenness of the voice at the other end, the excitement of the moment. What he had to say, however, was programmed in such a way that outsiders could not interfere with official business. This is Charles. There is a matter of concern to you. I propose a brief meeting and discussion. I'll be at the National Zoo in an hour, at the enclosure for the white tigers. How will I know you? The voice asked. I'll be carrying a copy of Newsweek in my left hand. 1 hour, the voice grumbled. He probably had an important meeting this morning, Ritter thought. Wasn't that too bad? The CIA field officer left the museum for his car. On the right seat was a copy of Newsweek he'd purchased at a drugstore on the way into town. Tactics, Kelly thought, turning to port, finally rounding Point Lookout. There was a wide selection. He still had his safe house in Baltimore with a false name on everything. The police might be interested in talking to him, but they hadn't made contact with him yet. He'd try to keep it that way. The enemy didn't know who he was. That was his starting place. The fundamental issue was the three-way balance among what he knew, what he didn't know, and how he might use the first to affect the second. The third element, the how, was tactics. He could prepare for what he did not yet know. He could not yet act upon it, but he actually knew what he would do. Getting to that point simply required a strategic approach to the problem. It was frustrating, though. Four young women awaited his action. An as-yet-undetermined number of people awaited death. They were driven by fear, Kelly knew. They'd been afraid of Pam and afraid of Doris. Afraid enough to kill. He wondered if the death of Edward Morello had been a further manifestation. Certainly they had killed for their safety, and now they probably did feel safe. That was good. If fear was their driving force, then they had more of it now that they felt it a thing of their past. The worrisome part was the time element. There was a clock on this. The police were sniffing at him. While he thought there was nothing they could possibly have to use against him, he still couldn't feel good about it. The other worry was the safety, he snorted, of those four young women. There was no such thing as a good, long operation. Well, he'd have to be patient on one thing, and with luck, just the one. He hadn't been to the zoo in years. Ritter thought he'd have to bring his kids here again now that they were old enough to appreciate things a little more. He took the time to look at the bear pit.
There was just something interesting about bears. Kids thought of them as large, animated versions of the stuffed toys they clutched at night. Not Ritter. They were the image of the enemy, large and strong, far less clumsy and far more intelligent than they appeared. A good thing to remember, he told himself, heading over to the tiger cage. He rolled the Newsweek in his left hand, watching the large cats and waiting. He didn't bother checking his watch. "Hello, Charles," a voice said beside him. "Hello, Sergei." "I do not know you," the resident observed. "This conversation is unofficial," Ritter explained. "Aren't they all?" Sergei noted. He started walking. Any single place could be bugged, but not a whole zoo. For that matter, his contact could be wearing a wire, though that would not have been in accordance with the rules, such as they were. He and Ritter walked down the gentle paved slope to the next animal exhibit, with the resident's security guard in close attendance. "I just returned from Vietnam," the CIA officer said. "Warmer there than here." "Not at sea. It's rather pleasant out there." "The purpose of your cruise?" the resident asked. "A visit. An unplanned one." "I believe it failed," the Russian said, not tauntingly, just letting Charles know that he knew what was going on. "Not completely. We brought someone home with us." "Who might that be?" "His name is Nikolai." Ritter handed over Grishinov's paybook. "It would be an embarrassment to your government if it were to be revealed that a Soviet officer was interrogating American POWs." "Not a great embarrassment," Sergei replied, flipping briefly through the paybook before pocketing it. "Well, actually, it would be. You see, the people he's been interrogating have been reported as being dead by your little friends." "I don't understand." He was telling the truth, and Ritter had to explain for a few minutes. "I did not know any of that," Sergei said after hearing the facts of the matter. "It's true, I assure you. You will be able to verify it through your own means." And he would, of course. Ritter knew that, and Sergei knew that he knew. "And where is our colonel?" "In a safe place. He's enjoying better hospitality than our people are." "Colonel Grishinov hasn't dropped bombs on anyone," the Russian pointed out. "That is true, but he did take part in a process that will end with the death of American prisoners, and we have hard evidence that they are alive. As I said earlier, a potential embarrassment for your government." Sergei Voloshin was a highly astute political observer and didn't need this young CIA officer to tell him that. He could also see where this discussion was headed. "What do you propose?" "It would be helpful if your government could persuade Hanoi to restore these men to life, as it were. That is, to take them to the same prison where the other prisoners are, and make the proper notifications so that their families will know they are alive after all. In return for that, Colonel Grishinov will be returned unharmed and uninterrogated." "I will forward that proposal to Moscow." "With a favorable endorsement," his tone said clearly. "Please be quick. We have reason to believe that the Vietnamese may be contemplating something drastic to relieve themselves of the potential embarrassment." "That would be a very serious complication," Ritter warned. "Yes, I suppose it would be." He paused. "Your assurance that Colonel Grishinov is alive and well?" "I can have you to him in, about 40 minutes, if you wish. Do you think I would lie about something as important as this?" "No, I do not. But some questions must be asked." "Yes, Sergei Ivanovich, I know that. We have no wish to harm your colonel. He seems to have behaved rather honorably in his treatment of our people. He was also a very effective interrogator. I have his notes." Ritter added, "The offer to meet with him is open if you wish to make use of it." Voloshin thought about it, seeing the trap. Such an offer, if taken, would have to be reciprocated, because that's the way things were. To call Ritter's hand on this would commit his own government to something, and Voloshin didn't want to do that without guidance. Besides, it would be madness for CIA to lie in a case like this. Those prisoners could always be made to disappear. Only the goodwill of the Soviet Union could save them, and only the continuance of that goodwill would keep them healthy.
I will take you at your word, Mr. Ritter. Bob Ritter.
Ah, Budapest. Ritter grinned rather sheepishly. Well, after all he'd done to get his agent out, it was clear that he'd never go back into the field again, at least not in any place that mattered, which, for Ritter, started at the River Elbe. The Russian poked him in the chest.
You did well getting your man out. I commend you on your loyalty to your agent.
Most of all, Voloshin respected him for the risk he'd taken, something not possible in the KGB.
Thank you, General. And thank you for responding to my proposal. When can I call you?
I'll need 2 days.
Shall I call you?
48 hours from now. I'll make the call.
Very well.
Good day. They shook hands like the professionals they were. Voloshin walked back to his driver, bodyguard, and headed back to the car. Their walk had ended up at the enclosure for the Kodiak bear, large, brown, and powerful. Had that been an accident, Ritter wondered. On the walk back to his car, he realized that the whole thing had been an accident of sorts. On the strength of this play, Ritter would become a section chief. Failed rescue mission or not, he'd just negotiated an important concession with the Russians. And it had all happened because of the presence of mind of a man younger than himself, scared and on the run, who'd taken the time to think. He wanted people like that in the agency, and now he had the clout to bring him in. Kelly had demurred and temporized on the flight back from Hawaii. Okay, so he'd need a little convincing. He'd have to work with Jim Greer on that, but Ritter decided on the spot that his next mission was to bring Kelly in from the cold, or the heat, or whatever you called it.
How well do you know Mrs. O'Toole? Ryan asked.
Her husband's dead, the neighbor said. He went to Vietnam right after they bought the house, and then he was killed. Such a nice young man, too. She's not in any trouble, is she?
The detective shook his head. No, not at all. I've only heard good things about her.
It's been awful busy over there, the elderly lady went on. She was the perfect person to talk to, about 65. A widow with nothing to do who compensated for the empty space in her life by keeping track of everyone else's. With a little reassurance that she wasn't hurting anyone, she'd relate everything she knew.
What do you mean?
I think she had a house guest a while back. She sure was shopping a lot more than usual. She's such a nice, pretty girl. It's so sad about her husband. She really ought to start dating again. I'd like to tell her, but I don't want her to think I'm nosy. Anyway, she was shopping a lot, and somebody else came almost every day, stayed overnight a lot even.
Who was that? Ryan asked, sipping his iced tea.
A woman, short like me, but heavier, messy hair. She drove a big car, a red Buick, I think, and it had a sticker thing on the windshield.
Oh, that's right. What's that? Ryan asked.
I was out with my roses when the girl came out. That's when I saw the sticker thing.
Girl? Ryan asked innocently.
That's who she was shopping for, the elderly lady said, pleased with herself for the sudden discovery. She bought clothes for her, I bet. I remember the Hecht Company bags.
Can you tell me what the girl looked like?
Young, like 19 or 20, dark hair, kind of pale like she was sick. They drove away. When was that? Oh, I remember. It's the day my new roses came from the nursery, the 11th. The truck came very early because I don't like the heat, and I was out there working when they came out. I waved at Sandy. She's such a nice girl. I don't talk to her very much, but when I do, she always has a kind word. She's a nurse, you know. She works at Johns Hopkins, and...
Ryan finished off his tea without letting his satisfaction show. Doris Brown had returned home to Pittsburgh on the afternoon of the 11th.
Sarah Rosen drove a Buick, and it undoubtedly had a parking sticker in the window. Sam Rosen, Sarah Rosen, Sandra O'Toole. They had treated Miss Brown. Two of them had also treated Miss Madden. They had also treated Mr. Kelly. After months of frustration, Lieutenant Emmett Ryan had a case. "There she is now," the lady said, startling him out of his private thoughts. Ryan turned and looked to see an attractive young lady on the tall side carrying a bag of groceries. "I wonder who that man was."
"What man?"
"He was there last night. Maybe she has a boyfriend after all. Tall, like you. Dark hair. Big."
"How do you mean?"
"Like a football player, you know. Big. He must be nice, though. I saw her hug him. That was just last night."
Thank God, Ryan thought, for people who don't watch TV.
For his long gun, Kelly had selected a bolt-action 22, a Savage Model 54, the lightweight version of that company's Anschutz match weapon. It was expensive enough at $150 with tax. Almost as costly were the Leupold scopes and mounts. The rifle was almost too good for its purpose, which was the hunting of small game, and had a particularly fine walnut stock. It was a shame that he'd have to scar it up. It would have been more of a shame to waste the lesson from that chief machinist's mate, however. The one bad thing about the demise of Eddie Morello was that sweetening the deal had required the loss of a large quantity of pure, uncut heroin, a 6-kilogram donation to the police evidence locker. That had to be made up. Philadelphia was hungry for more, and his New York connections were showing increasing interest now that they'd had their first taste. He'd do one last batch on the ship. Now he could change over again. Tony was setting up a secure lab that was easier to reach, more in keeping with the burgeoning success he was enjoying. But until that was ready, one more time the old way. He wouldn't make the trip himself.
"How soon?" Bert asked.
"Tonight."
"Fair enough, boss. Who goes with me?"
"Phil and Mike."
The two new ones were from Tony's organization, young, bright, ambitious. They didn't know Henry yet, and would not be part of his local distribution network. But they could handle out-of-town deliveries, and were willing to do the menial work that was part of this business, mixing and packaging. They saw it, not inaccurately, as a rite of passage, a starting place from which their status and responsibility would grow. Tony guaranteed their reliability. Henry accepted that. He and Tony were bound now. Bound in business, bound in blood. He'd accept Tony's counsel now that he trusted him. He'd rebuild his distribution network, removing the need for his female couriers, and with the removal of the need for them, so would end the reason for their lives. It was too bad, but with 3 defections, it was plain that they were becoming dangerous. A useful part of his operation in the growth phase, perhaps, but now a liability. But one thing at a time.
"How much?" Bert asked.
"Enough to keep you busy for a while."
Henry waved to the beer coolers. There wasn't room for much beer in them now, but that was as it should be. Bert carried them out to his car, not casual, but not tense. Businesslike, the way things should be. Perhaps Bert would become his principal lieutenant. He was loyal, respectful, tough when he had to be. Far more dependable than Billy or Rick, and a brother. It was funny, really. Billy and Rick had been necessary at the beginning since the major distributors were always white, and he'd taken them on as tokens. Well, fate had settled that. Now the white boys were coming to him, weren't they?
"Take Xantha with you."
"Boss, we're going to be busy," Bert objected.
"You can leave her there when you're done."
Perhaps one at a time was the best way to do it. Patience never came easy. It was a virtue he'd learned after a fashion, but only from necessity. Activity helped. He set the gun barrel in the vise, damaging the finish even before he started to do anything substantive.
setting the milling machine on high speed, rotating the control wheel, he started drilling a series of holes at regular intervals in the outermost 6 inches of the barrel. An hour later, he had a steel can body affixed over it, and the telescopic sight attached. The rifle, as modified, proved to be quite accurate, Kelly thought.
Tough one, Dad?
11 months worth, Jack, Emmett admitted over dinner. He was home on time for once, to his wife's pleasure. Almost.
That awful one, his wife asked.
Not over dinner, honey, okay, he replied, answering the question. Emmett did his best to keep that part of his life out of the house. He looked over at his son and decided to comment on a decision his son recently made.
Marines, eh?
Well, Dad, it pays for the last 2 years of school, doesn't it? It was like his son to worry about things like that, about the cost of education for his sister, still in high school and away at camp for the moment. And, like his father, Jack craved a little adventure before settling down to whatever place life would find for him.
My son, a jarhead, Emmett grumbled good-naturedly.
He also worried. Vietnam wasn't over, might not be over when his son graduated. And, like most fathers of his generation, he wondered why the hell he'd had to risk his life fighting Germans, so that his son might have to do the same, fighting people he'd never even heard about at his son's age.
What falls out of the sky, Pop? Jack asked with a college boy grin, repeating something Marines like to say.
Such talk worried Catherine Burke Ryan, who remembered seeing Emmett off, remembered praying all day in St. Elizabeth Church on June 6, 1944, and many days thereafter, despite the regular letters and assurances. She remembered the waiting. She knew this kind of talk worried Emmett, too, though not quite in the same way.
What falls out of the sky? Trouble, the detective almost told his son.
For the airborne, too, were a proud group, but the thought stopped before it got to his lips.
Kelly, we tried calling him. We had the Coast Guard look at that island he lives on. The boat wasn't there. The boat wasn't anywhere.
Where was he?
He was back now, though, if the little old lady was right. What if he was away, but now he's back?
The killings just plain stopped after the Farmer Grayson Brown incident. The marina had remembered seeing the boat about that time, but he'd left in the middle of the night, that night, and just vanished. Connection. Where had the boat been? Where was it now?
What falls out of the sky?
Trouble.
That's exactly what had happened before. It just dropped out of the sky, started and stopped.
His wife and son saw it again, chewing on his food, his eyes focused on infinity, unable to turn his mind off as it churned his information over and over.
Kelly's not really all that different from what I used to be, Ryan thought.
101, the Screaming Eagles of the 101st Infantry Division, airborne, who still swaggered in their baggy pants. Emmett had started off as a buck private, ended up with a late-war battlefield commission to the rank he still held, lieutenant. He remembered the pride of being something very special, the sense of invincibility that strangely came arm-in-arm with the terror of jumping out of an aircraft, being the first on enemy territory, in the dark, carrying light weapons only. The hardest men with the hardest mission.
Mission.
He'd been like that once. But no one had ever killed his lady. What might have happened, back in 1946 perhaps, if someone had done that to Catherine?
Nothing good.
He'd saved Doris Brown. He'd given her over to people he trusted. He'd seen one of them last night. He knows she's dead. He saved Pamela Madden. She died. And he was in the hospital. And a few weeks after he got out, people started dying in a very expert way. A few weeks. To get in shape. Then the killings just stopped, and Kelly was nowhere to be found. What if he's just been away? He's back now. Something's going to happen. It wasn't a thing he could take to court.
The only physical evidence they had was the imprint of a shoe sole. A common brand of sneaker, of course. 100 sold every day. Zilch. They had motive. But how many murders happened every year?